couple of announcements. Number one, just a reminder, there will be no Bible class the 24th and 25th, and the 31st of December and the 1st of January. We will have class every Sunday through that time. And secondly, we're still in the middle of getting the setup schedule set up, so each member of the royal family should participate in this. We all benefit from the matter of having Bible class, so we should participate in making sure that the things get done so it doesn't fall on just a few believers to do this. Everybody should be willing to take their stand in the household and do what's incumbent upon us as believers in order to facilitate application and all of that. So we still need about 6 months on that, so please see Bill and take your turn. All right, we're here under major point five. Let's make sure you are in fellowship. And let's continue on here. We're dealing with the categories of love. The first one, of course, where it all begins, because if you don't love God effectively, none of these others are really going to fall into place. Failure to love God will damage, at some level, these other relationships that God provides under His grace. And certainly, if two believers both love God, we're dealing now with category two love, marriage. And again, I didn't put it all in here, but of course, this presupposes heterosexual, monogamous marriage for life. That's the norm. That's the ideal. That's the standard. Now, that doesn't always work out. We know that. There is grace after divorce. We do not encourage divorce, and we certainly do not encourage it for non-biblical reasons. But I've observed believers who are just at a standstill in their lives spiritually, and if it becomes a drag on your Christian life, at some point you have to pick the lesser of the two evils. Not to say that it's correct, but even under the Mosaic law, there was provision made for this matter of divorce. It was never God's directed will. And of course, Jesus makes that all plain when they come to him about marriage. But they were coming at him with this matter of the Pharisaical understanding of, can a man divorce his wife for any reason? Like she burns the toast. She used all the hot water in the shower. Yes, those are divorceable offenses. Matter of fact, I don't know how anybody could live under that kind of terrorism. That's an act of terrorism. Everything is nowadays. It's all acts of terrorism. Well, you know, what murder isn't designed to strike terror at some point? I mean, seriously. So, no, they wanted to get out of this for non-biblical reasons, nitpicky reasons, and Jesus had none of that. So mutual affection, as we're here, it's commanded of both parties. We're 1 Corinthians. We have not even read the verse yet. 1 Corinthians 7. We looked at this a little earlier in more detail than we're going to look at it here, just to say that this is one of the categories of love. But because of each of immoralities, each man is to have his own wife and each woman is to have her own husband. The husband must fulfill his sexual duty to his wife, and likewise also the wife must fulfill her sexual duty to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. This may be considered blasphemous in some doctrinal churches, but yes, women have authority. They have authority in certain areas. Whether people like it or not, I don't care. It doesn't matter to me. The Bible's very plain on this. And here's one of those verses you can't get around it. Yeah, she has authority over you at a certain level. And that's generally been ignored, not just in doctrinal churches, but in other churches as well. So, mutual affection and emotional support is necessary for the sexual aspect of the marriage to be enjoyed to the maximum. How many people are going to fight for 8 hours and then fall into bed and make passionate love? Normal people do not do that. You may have some weird thing going on. I don't know. I don't want to know about it, probably. You know, the greatest of the sadists and the masochists, too. But the fact is, mutual affection, emotional support, and this is where men have historically dropped the ball. We are not emotional as women are. I know that. It's a challenge to sometimes just express You know, the simplest of things. Because men aren't wired that way. I get it. And we're swimming upstream in a big way against the male psyche and against a male-dominated society. And against things that have been ingrained about men have all the authority. I mean, I don't know how many times I've heard the pulpit pounded on this one. But it's just not true. When you consider the Bible carefully, there are two sides to all of this. And so, again, emotional support is necessary. If people do not feel loved, if they don't have any sense of support and camaraderie, well, the sex life's not going to be anything, because it's to flow out of the natural, normal reality of what marriage is to be. And a bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. So sex is not to be withheld, point B, by either partner. The wife must not resort to using sex as a weapon in this relationship. I say that, but both parties can be guilty of this. I mean, back when I wrote this, and of course this doctrine's, I don't know how many years old, but I mean, I go over it and I update it when I go through it, but the fact is, neither partner should resort to using sex. I may have to change this. As a matter of fact, let's change that. Neither partner should resort to using sex as a weapon. Because people can do this. And guess what? When you start using sex as a weapon, you're playing a real, real dangerous game. Because one of the other partners may crack under this. And as I've told you before, very much like sporting events, it's very often the second person that retaliates that gets caught. That things aren't right in the home, and somebody goes out and does something. Of course, everybody's shocked at the overt, but what's going on behind the scenes that led up to all this? That's what you have to be wise enough to try to figure out. Whenever there is a marriage that doesn't work out, there aren't innocent parties. They're both guilty. Both could make decisions to change this. Now, it doesn't mean that they will, but the fact is, I don't see, generally speaking, now there could be an exception to this, but as a general rule, I don't see one person being totally at fault in a failed marriage at all. I think both people contributed to it. And so, 1 Corinthians 7:5, stop depriving one another. That's why this should read, neither partner should resort. I didn't look at it here, but I'm sure it's the reciprocal pronoun. Yeah, hallelujah. So both are responsible to not do this, except by agreement for a time. Now, there is a time and a place. If you're committing yourself to some spiritual important reality that requires a lot of prayer, self-discipline and dedication and all of that, okay, then you have an out on this, but only for a period of time. This can't be used indefinitely. Well, I'm still praying about it 6 months later. No, that's not what Paul envisions here at all. And because the reality is that there is a spiritual element to all of this and the spiritual attacks that come because of the lack of self-control. Some wife may say to her husband, you're not getting sex again until I say so. Then he goes out and commits adultery. Who's at fault? Both of them. You say, well, she didn't do anything. She didn't commit adultery. No, but she pushed him into it. If I push you off the cliff and you fall to your death, who's at fault? You, you idiot. You fell. No, I share a blame in that. And in fact, I would say I was the culpable one if I push you off a cliff. Well, we're not talking about pushing someone to their death, but we may push them to death in their marriages by these types of behaviors. And the same thing's true for the husband. Again, I don't want to focus on this. Only women do this. But you're not going to fight all day and fuss and fight and be at each other and all of that and then just have a wonderful sex life. It just doesn't happen that way. And you're not going to treat your wife like a dog all day and then come home and say, come here, honey, lay down. Come on. You know, that's treating her like a dog still, see? And or the other way around. The wife can do it too. She can be just as guilty of this as husbands are. I know men can be insensitive. I'm one of the exceptions to that. Nobody's ever accused me of, well, wait a second, this week anyway. I'm being facetious again. So neither is the husband to use it, point C, as some sort of spiritual way to bully his wife. We're not here to bully our women. This has been tolerated and in fact encouraged in doctrinal churches. And I've heard it. I know it's true. I've sat through it. And I've heard different other tapes, other works, and I've seen how this has been handled. And sadly, it's not. It's been used as a club. Authority is used as a club. And I hear pastors, you know, I've heard this. So I know it's true. I've heard it with my own ears. This is not hearsay. Tell him, well, you may be married to a spiritual clunker. Well, that's a good way to encourage your husbands to love their wives. You may be married to a spiritual clunker. You're like an old jalopy you got here. And how's that encouraging anything? It doesn't. That kind of talk is counterproductive, frankly. So, again, very often authority and all of this has been used as a club to bully people. We're not here to use authority as a club. We have authority as pastors, as deacons, as men, but using it rightly is another whole issue. And that's part of what you're going to be evaluated on at the Bema Seat. How did you use that authority? Demanding sex at any time, I've heard this kind of nonsense. If I tell my wife I want sex, and if I want it 10 times a day, she's got to do it. The Bible doesn't say that. That's human viewpoint, traditions of men. And it's not biblical. At first, that's excessive and ridiculous. Any normal man would tell you that. I was young once. And I wasn't having sex 10 times a day. I didn't even want sex 10 times. Well, I might have, but I don't know. I don't remember now totally. But I didn't have sex 10 times a day and didn't have to demand it. I mean, that's sad. But that's not the way it's supposed to be. And I've heard this. If you tell your wife to get up and go bake a cake, she's got to go bake a cake. Now, Abraham told Sarah to cook bread and it was really hot and she got up and did it. Well, yes, you should generally obey your husband. But husbands also have responsibilities not to make excessive and unreasonable demands. Just as every authority does. What's it say to the fathers? Do not exasperate your children. Well, men go around exasperating their wives and then they wonder why she's pissed off. I think I know. And I've done it. This is where, you know, you get in real trouble because you got a real failure here in front of you. So I know how this works. I've failed. I've been on both sides of it, succeeded and failed. So, again, you expect the wife to comply with unreasonable demands with no regard for her well-being. Well, that's not putting her first. That's not agapao. That's I'm demanding my own way. In fact, if anything, that's just strictly selfishness at its minimum. Well, the husband's highest expression of love, point four here, for his wife is to be characterized by understanding the principle of the weaker vessel. And the concept of self-sacrifice. What? 1 Peter 3:7. Again, to point out that logical contextual consistency here demands that we're talking about submission to authority. Because that's what begins this whole section back in chapter 2. Really, in verse, what is it, about 8 or 10? No, maybe a little further. To 12. Submit yourself to 13. Submit yourself. And this all begins with submission. The whole concept of submission. The book of 1 Peter, probably about a third of it is just dealt with submission to authority. Roughly a third of it. Maybe a little less. Maybe a fourth. Submit yourself for the Lord's sake to every human institution. Whether to the king as one in authority. Okay, that's all fine and good. We got that. We submit to those in power. And submit yourself there in verse 13. Servants, verse 18. Be submissive to your masters with all respect. Okay, now we deal not only with the establishment chain of command, the rules and laws of society out there that govern society. I'm not saying they're perfect. They don't have to be. Our job is to submit to them as much as possible and not violate these things. We are not to be rabble-rousers. Submit yourselves to every human institution. I watched the other day as I saw Jane Fonda on TV. And I thought, what's she doing out there? Oh, she moved to D.C. just so she could be engaged in civil disobedience every day. That's what I believe the Christian is called to try to make a splash with civil disobedience. No, not at all. So then you got the job. Be submissive to your masters and all of this. Then you get into chapter 3. In the same way, you wives. In what same way? The same way he's just been talking about the establishment chain of command and your job. Then in the same way, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands. So that even if any of them are disobedient, they may be won without a word. And then you husbands, verse 7, is where we're looking now, in the same way. In what same way? In the way of submission. That's all he's been talking about, is learning how to submit and practicing it. In the same way, live with your wives in an understanding way, as with someone weaker. Since she is a female, is better than woman here. She's a female. And females, generally speaking, are physically weaker than males. They may be emotionally weaker. In some cases, they're emotionally stronger. So you can't just hardly generalize, but the generalization is that women are weaker than men in a number of ways that should be taken into account. And women that try to act like men and say, well, I'm not going to show weakness, I'm in charge, I'm going to call it a shot, blah, blah, blah. Well, you're completely out of it. You are completely out of it spiritually with that attitude. That is not the godly woman attitude. So live with your wives in an understanding way. That means according to knowledge, literally in the Greek. Now, what knowledge? Well, the knowledge of doctrine. What does doctrine teach about all of this? Since she is a female, show her honor as a fellow heir of the grace of life. And again, honor may very well have more than just, as we've seen in other places, honor can have a financial component to it. I've seen husbands that spend all the money they want, and then they put their wives on a budget and say, okay, here's your allowance. That is just so freaking wrong. You know, I can spend anything I want, but you can't. That is absolutely wrong. You should be just as willing for her to have what you have. And that also can go the other way, vice versa. Everything I'm saying true here can be reversed. There can be women who are running the show financially, and they put their husband on an allowance. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? No. This happens. And so the reality of it is, fellow heir here stresses the fact that we have a mutual Lord, and we have a mutual destiny. And that destiny should impact our life in the here and now. Here. So, the fellow heir of the grace that is life. I'd have to look at this. I haven't done this one in context. I'd be curious to see how that genitive is to be dealt with there. So that your prayers will not be hindered. So why do people not get their prayers answered? Well, they're failing in this. They're failing in this matter of mutual submission. Their marriages have problems. So they pray to God. Why? Because God's not listening until you deal with certain things. Especially if you're running around with bitterness and unforgiveness towards each other. Your prayers are going to be hindered. First, you're going to be out of fellowship a lot. And isn't that fun? Don't you just love fighting? Doesn't that just make your day and your week just to have a good old knockdown drag out? No, it doesn't. It's depressing. It's distressing. It's discouraging. It's all the things you don't want in life. So, again, you want your prayers answered. Well, guess what? You're going to have to orient to certain things. Or God is straight out here. I don't think this is an idle threat. I think people don't get what they want sometimes from the Lord because they're at odds with these principles. And God's not impressed by all this. So he'll deal with it. So again, the weaker vessel there. And then Ephesians 5, back to that. Oh, we've read verse 25 there. We just saw that one. But there's a lengthy section here. So we'll deal with all this when we get it. 25 and 28. So husbands also ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his own wife loves himself. Because normal people don't hate their own flesh, but nourishes it and cherishes it, just as Christ does the church. And the idea, I suspect, here is his own flesh is the wife. It is a reference to the one flesh principle that was set forth in Genesis. Well, the highest expression of love, that should be love, is to become her husband's friend, which will enable her to submit to his authority even under the most difficult of circumstances. See, you do things for your friends. You talk a certain way to them. I've been guilty of it. I've seen it. You know, we don't talk to each other sometimes in the household the same way we talk to anybody else. You ever done that? No, just us. Okay. Well, you have a negative example now. So you can figure that out. But if you treat somebody as a friend, if they're a friend, well, you have a particular demeanor that you would use. And the same thing should be true in the household. Now, and again, every one of us has failed. I would dare say, I don't, if you can stand up and contradict me, you've never had a fight, you've never been out of fellowship, you've never done anything wrong, okay. Then maybe this church isn't for you because you're surrounded by a bunch of numbskulls. Maybe this isn't it. But the fact is, we've all failed in this. But and you don't have to go running around and parading your failures before everybody. I don't call somebody and say, oh man, I called Linda a bunch of bad things and she called me a bunch of bad things back and this is fun. No, it's not fun. It's gross and you got to get over it and move on. But we do things at home that we wouldn't do out in public, frankly. And we should. That's where we have to work on it. And by the way, now that most of us are older, over 50, some of us over 60, some of us over 70, where do you think the mass majority of your rewards are coming from? Where do you think you're going to get SG3? And I would say that the vast majority are going to come from your home life. I mean, you obviously have to apply towards the local church. Hence the deal about setting up. We each take our turn. We're a family. We participate. We help. But normal families like to do that. And so we have that. But the reality here is, you do things at home you wouldn't do out in public. But where's your SG3 coming from? It's going to be from your marriage, most likely. How many hours a day do you spend with this woman, this man? Too many. That's why God made martinis. Kidding, again, that's not why he made martinis. But the fact is, where's your SG3 coming from? You're spending 8, 10, 12 hours a day with this person, and you don't apply towards them? You don't take these things seriously? You're losing out big time to apply to be that way. Well, B, women may begin the relationship as the more flexible of the partners. Probably are. See, men, when they're dating, they're on their best behavior. They're trying to impress you. They want you to think they're cool and all of that, you know. And so you'll marry them. And then they marry it. Again, much like a dog chasing a bus, once they've caught it, they don't know what to do with it. But women may be more flexible. However, the real danger is that failure to consistently love her husband can cause her to become a contentious woman. I use the word woman there instead of another word, but I think we all know what it was. And we don't want to be that. Women should not strive for that. How do you know if you're a contentious woman? You argue with everything he says. That's your first big clue right there. Everything he says, your first instinct is to say no. You're contentious. That's contentious. It is better to live in the corner of a roof. Let's see, in Sarasota, I think average temperature is going to be in the summer about 150 degrees or higher than with a house shared with a contentious woman. I'd rather live outside is the ideal. Or in the smallest of spaces, the most uncomfortable of spots I'd rather be in than with an argumentative, bitchy woman. So there, also verse 19, same chapter. Oh, now it's better to live in a desert land than with a contentious and vexing woman. How do you know if you're vexing? If your husband stands around hollering at you, you probably vexed him. Most likely. I mean, it doesn't mean you did it all the time. It doesn't mean that's the only reason he hollers. But that can certainly be a big part of it. So you're better off facing dehydration and death now. This has upped it a little bit. You live in a small, cramped spot in the corner of an attic. Now you're better off facing dehydration and certain death than to live with this kind of woman. And women, really, is this who you want to be deep down? Because if you think this is acceptable, it's not. This is not God's will. Also, chapter 27, 17, or 15, I'm sorry. Well, do we need to read this? I think it speaks for itself. A constant dripping. And then it gets louder and louder, of course. On a day of steady rain, and a contentious woman are alike. He who would try to restrain her restrains the wind and grasps oil with his right hand. You know what it is about contentious women? You're better off trying to catch oil in your hand. And you're better off trying to get the wind to quit blowing. What do you think your odds of success are in those two things? Of holding oil in your hand. You might be able to hold a little bit. A vast majority of it's going to run out. And you can no more restrain the wind than you can do this. And so, again, these are the issues. This is what works in marriage and doesn't work. Argumentative, contentious women do not glorify God. Now, that doesn't mean there's not a place for a woman to stand up to her, for herself or to say no. But she certainly ought to be praying about it and attempt to be in fellowship. When your first response is to scream no and run the other way, you're not handling that according to doctrine. There's no way God's in that. We're talking about you can stand up for yourself and still be respectful. And still say, express respect for authority and all of that. You don't have to, handle it wrongly. But people get under their sin natures and then they say, by God, I'm going to deal with this. Well, uh-oh. Note that Sarai, and Sarai means one who strives. That's what Sarai meant, was contentious, argumentative. This was her first name. I wonder why her parents named her that. Well, obviously, there's a certain deal in the Bible and in life in general, I think, where names aren't accidental. God's named every family, right? We just saw that. Names don't come accidentally. There are things in life where your name is going to is reflective of who you want to be, hopefully, or who you are, even worse. So Sarai, bitchy, began as somewhat of a demanding woman and grew into a princess, a great woman of God who was characterized by her willing submission to Abraham. Genesis 17 gives us sort of the background to this. Genesis 17, 15. And God said to Abraham, as for Sarai, your wife, argumentative, you shall not call her name argumentative, but princess shall be her name. And I will bless her, and I indeed will give you a son by her. And so, which woman, what would you rather be, a Sarai or a Sarah? Just using the play on words in those two names. And the point is, God has ways of working in the life to perform that which is pleasing in His sight and help women to become what they're supposed to be. Because again, I sympathize with women in the fact, number one, they have one extra authority than men have. That doesn't mean men don't have authorities. They do. They have to still deal with the pastor and the deacons and the royal chain of command, the establishment chain of command, their boss. They have authorities. And again, if a man is failing in regard to his authorities, what do you think is going to happen regarding the ones under your authority? Do you think God's going to let her say, okay, well, you badmouth your boss, you disregard the laws of the land, you do what you want to, and yet when it comes to your wife, you're puzzled because she won't obey you? Maybe these things are connected. Maybe her lack of obedience speaks to your lack of obedience. And or failure under certain things. I can't know for sure. So there we see the name change then in chapter 18, verse 12. Sarah laughed to herself, saying, so this is all done mentally. Nobody knows she's doing this except her and God. And of course, the Lord calls her out on it. After I have become old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also? And there she calls Abraham her Lord, her master, in her mind. She didn't do this overtly. She didn't do it to impress people. I mean, after several times, I've been in a couple of doctrinal churches. After this was taught, you'd hear women running around saying, well, my Lord said. I'm not impressed with that, so don't try to impress me by doing that. My Lord said, yeah, okay. How do you call him at home? The old, well... You fill in the blank. Let your imagination run wild there. But she did this mentally. She didn't do it to impress anybody. She didn't do it to impress Abraham. This was the way she thought. Her thinking had been transformed. And she recognized, okay. And then, of course, he Lord calls her on the carpet, why did Sarah laugh? This is all funny. But we haven't got time for that today. No point in humor. We're dealing with marriage. no place for levity in marriage. No jokes until camp set up. So he talks about Sarah and how godly women in the church age are to live. For in this way, in former times, in what way? Like Sarah did. They worked on the inner woman. They didn't work on the external. They weren't concerned with that so much. Doesn't mean they didn't look good or take care of themselves. It just means that wasn't their primary emphasis. So 1 Peter 3, 5, and 6. In the same way, the holy women also who hoped in God. Who do you aspire to be? Who's your example? There are biblical examples we can look to and learn about and follow and emulate. Who hoped in God, used to adorn themselves. How? Internally. Being submissive to their own husbands, that's what God's looking for. Just as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, and you have become her daughters if you do what is right, without being frightened by any fear. You can't lose in this, woman. In the end, God will take care of it. You say, well, my husband won't worry it. Yes, don't worry. God has ways of pounding on his head. I've been under discipline before, specifically because of the way I treated my wife, and I knew it. There's been two or three things. Some of them are so bad, I won't even share them with you. But there were times when I experienced a lot. God ran me through a lot of physical pain and discomfort, and I knew why. I knew exactly why it was happening. And so then physical pain, that works. I was willing to pull my horns in then. Oh, well, I think I'll treat her better. Don't want to go through this again. And so several times I've had things happen. You know, and something small from like stubbing my toe, smarted off to her, walked into the study, just hit my toe right on the corner of the desk. You know what it's like when you stub your big toe with no shoes on? Mm. Oh, it brings tears to your eyes almost. And that minor little discipline to literally an outpatient surgery because of the way I treated her. So you think, well, God, that's a lot of ground. It is a lot of ground. And God has ways of getting through to the hardest of men and the hardest of heads. So what might God do? I don't know, but you don't want to find out. And I can give you a warning. I'll just leave it with an outpatient surgery that wasn't fun. And but the fact is, I knew why I was getting it. The nurse was getting me ready. Said, "You know, well, God, has this ever happened before?" "No." "Well, what do you think caused it?" I said, "Well, I can tell you what caused it," and I spelled it out to her. I was mean to my wife. I really treated her badly, and God lowered the boom on me. She just looked at me like I had three heads, but that was what happened. I told her the truth. That was the good testified the good confession. I'm an idiot. Got in trouble with God. Well, both the husband and wife, point six, must recognize the word of God never sanctions the breaking of the marriage vows. Divorce is not a biblical option. We know there's two outs to that. And we know there's really a third one under the permissive will, but we're talking about the directive will here. That under the permissive will, people divorce. There's not anything we can do about that. But we strive, of course, or should strive, for the directive will of God and not be running for the permissive will. And this is what we cited earlier. Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason? What? Any reason? No, there's only two. And so why then, as they say, the two are no longer separate, but verse 6, but one flesh. Then they said, then why did Moses command to give her a certificate and send her away? And he said, Moses, because of your hardness of heart. So divorce happens, and I can tell you why it happens. It happens because of hardness of heart on one or both people's parts. That's why it happens. Moses permitted you. Number one, Jesus corrects their mistake here. He didn't command it, he permitted it. And that's our position on it. We would never command it, we permit it. To give her a certificate of divorce and send her away. Because of your hardness of heart, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, it has not been this way. But I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for immorality and marries another woman commits adultery. And the disciple said to him, if the relationship of the man with his wife is like this, it's better not to marry. Because, I mean, what happens if I want to trade up? What happens if she doesn't meet every little whim I have? Oh, she won't. Don't worry. Well, they just go to the extreme and say, well, you're better off not getting married than to have to live like that. But that their culture, that was so foreign to males in their culture that they just said, well, just throw out the baby with the bathwater. We'll just throw out marriage. You don't need marriage if it's like this. Because they were not interested in humbling themselves. And he said, well, there are people who can. But for most people, most normal people are going to get married. 1 Corinthians also 7. This has again been wrongly mislabeled as Paul's, the Pauline privilege that you can separate but not get divorced. But that is not at all what this is teaching. At all. To the married, I give instructions, not I, but the Lord, that the wife should not leave her husband. But Paul immediately opts and deals with the permissive will. But if she does leave, maybe she will, maybe she won't. Third class condition, but he leaves it open as an option. If she does leave. Now, and again, women can leave marriage just for a bunch of reasons. Some right, some wrong. If they get out of it because they're trying, their life's in danger, or their husband's involved in criminal activity, or this or that, that's another whole deal. Those, we recognize there are exceptions to all the rules. Yeah, generally speaking, the rules are death and adultery. But obviously, self-preservation's got to be a huge part of this. You have to be alive to advance spiritually. So you can't be in these situations. I just saw the news today. Yeah, it was this morning. And, you know, there was some shooting down here. Was that in a trailer park by chance? There was some shooting in a trailer park down in Nokomis. And so this guy's beating his wife up, I guess, as best I could tell. And he was on top of her with a gun. And the cops are there. But this woman decides to intervene and jumps on this guy with a gun. Which I wouldn't recommend at all. And he, even the cop, said, well, hey, you know, we're here, we're trained in this. Maybe you should stay out of this. But anyway, ended up, the guy got shot, I guess died. Certainly, if I would think that woman had more than a sufficient cause to get out of her marriage. If you're pinned to the ground with a guy on top of you with a gun, that's probably not safe. You could die. And a lot of times, of course, in terms of people that are violent, it doesn't improve, it gets worse. The violence increases as you go if you don't deal with it. And so you have to get to the point, really, the best point to get to, is when that mental attitude sin of anger crops up. Nobody here gets it, I know, but I've had to deal with it. But when that crops up, you better jump on it right friggin' then and get on top of it. Because the next thing may be a mental attitude sin that leads to a punch or a push or some physical interaction. And that's obviously never appropriate in marriage. Just not. But it happens. But if you're under that kind of stress and danger, well, yeah, you can leave. And by leaving, he means divorce. He doesn't mean she can leave as in she can separate. This is what people have taught wrongly here. She must remain unmarried. That tells me he meant divorced by leave. That's God's directive will for her. Or else be reconciled to her husband. And the husband should not divorce his wife. But to the rest I say that if any brother has a wife who's an unbeliever, and she consents to live with him, he must not divorce her. And a woman who has an unbeliever... See, you can't divorce over this matter of a split marriage. I have a mixed marriage. That's not a legitimate reason. You made a vow to marry that person and stay with them for the rest of your life, and God expects you to honor it. I mean, that's just straightforward what we've got here. So sending the husband away, he uses these things interchangeably. Leaving, divorcing, sending away, and all of that. Those are all synonyms for divorce. That's what they are. So this idea, well, I can just separate from my husband or wife and we'll be fine before the Lord. Nope, that's not what the Scripture teaches. That may be what men allow, but that's, again, the traditions of men, not the Bible. So this is why we encourage young people. Hey, you got to have your hormones. You're going to hit puberty and you're going to want to get married. And you're going to fall in love. True love. And it's going to last forever, of course. And they'll never do any wrong. And you know how naive you were when you were a teenager, right? Or 20. or 25. You know, naivete doesn't leave necessarily once you get out of the teenage years. And guess what? You never know what it's going to be. And so don't be in too big of a hurry. This is what we tell young people. Don't be in too big of a hurry. Take your time. Look for somebody who's positive. Because you're in this for the long haul. And there's a certain part of your Christian life and all you won't be able to share with a negative spouse to speak of. They don't understand it. They can't. I mean, you could talk to a turtle and have the same relationship in some ways. As far as their understanding goes, I mean. I'm not saying they're shelled off or anything. And the same thing is true. It doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman. If you marry somebody who's not positive, you're going to miss out on certain things. You just are. And we would rather have you not do that, but to have the fullness of God's plan in your life. So divorce here, as you see, is not an option, not a biblical option. It is permitted under only two circumstances, and in neither case is it commanded: immorality, Matthew 19:9, and the case of an unbeliever abandoning a believer. Now, in that case, this is the one we didn't get quite that far, but in verse 15, if the unbelieving one leaves, let him leave. In other words, if a person wants out of the marriage and they're not a believer, or if they're negative even, your job isn't to stop them. Your job isn't to try to get in their way. If they insist on this, well, you just have to acquiesce. Now, you're still under the same principles. The principles don't change. You say, well, what if my unbelieving spouse leaves? You're still not permitted to remarry. Not biblically. Not under the directive will. Now, you may opt for the permissive will, but that doesn't make it right. And people have and do, and we know all this. But this is an option where you do have an out, and that is if the person just insists on divorce and you can't salvage the marriage, well, okay, then let it go. You're better off. There's less wear and tear on you to just let it go. And I say less wear and tear, how emotional will it be to lose someone that you loved, thought you were going to be with forever, and the devastating impact of that? Divorce is never easy, and it's never easy on anyone. And I think God's instituted that into it. It's not supposed to be easy. And of course, if factor in the sin nature now to all of that, and the vindictive nature of people, and how under certain circumstances, you know how people are. I'm normal human. Somebody strikes at you, you want to strike back. That's the normal human response. And that obviously happens in divorce court a lot. And people aren't ready to just say, well, hey, let's just be nice about this, divide it all up equally, go our separate ways, and be happy. That's not usually how divorces go at all. They're far more contentious generally because you've got sin natures involved in it now. Hurt sin natures. Angry sin natures. And those are the worst kind. So category two love here includes parental love for children. A natural affection between the parent and child is expected in the normal home. This must, by biblical definition, also include the concept of normal loving discipline. Titus 2:4, we'd seen that. That's where the women are to be encouraged to love their husbands, to raise their children, and be keepers at home. I believe that was the one there. So this is what you encourage, how you encourage young women to live, to love their children. You think, well, women normally tend to love their children. Yeah, but you can, and again, he uses phileo here, another compound term. Philotechnos. And to love their children. Because your children can wear on you. And for those of us who have negative children, there's not anything you can do about it. You can agonize over it, but it won't change it. And at some point, you just have to let it go. No matter how much you love your children, you can't protect them from everything. This is one of the mistakes parents make. Oh, I'm going to make sure my child never endures any of that. Good luck. How are you going to save them from the world? How are you going to save them from their own stupidity sometimes? You can try to help them, but if they don't want help and they don't, and very often they don't. And as parents, you have to be very careful about with your children being overly involved in, especially after they leave the house. Now, they have their own lives then. They're no longer under your authority or responsibility. They don't. And some, I've heard people try this on me. Well, I know I don't live at home anymore, but I'm functioning under the honor your father and mother principle. No, you're not. That's about parents in their old age needing money. And essentially, this is a way for people to say, well, I'm still doing what my parents tell me, even though I'm my own man. No, you're not. You're not your own man if you're doing that. You're not obligated to let your parents run your marriage. And in fact, they should be told to butt out. Stay out of it. And that's challenging, I know, especially if you love your kids. And most normal parents love their kids. You want to help them, but stay out of it. And we've seen, many of us could give testimony, oh yes, I love my kids, I want to help them, and now I'm paying for it. Because I made stupid decisions and should have just stayed out of it. And you should. As a parent, that's, you do your best when you raise them, and then you cut them loose when they leave. And, you know, generally speaking, it's going to be them that leaves. Most of us don't ever run our children out of the home. They want to leave. But that's normal. And all that. So love their children. And then also Hebrews 12:7. This is in the context of discipline. Of God's discipline. And the fact that if this is true at a spiritual level, it's certainly true at an earthly level. Or should be. God deals with you as sons. Here's an axiomatic question. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? This question demands a no answer, a negative answer. There isn't one. Normal parents discipline their children. And parents that didn't ever spank their kids, you can almost pick these kids out of a crowd. I can pick them out. They're arrogant. They're mouthy. Nobody ever took them down a peg or two. And boy, it sure makes me want to. But I'm not their parent and I can't. But slap their face back around to the side of their head, that'll teach them. But you can't do that. I'm not advocating that you do that. But that's just that's the response it engenders in me when I see these negative little twits who've never been disciplined. And the parents said, oh, I'm doing my kids a favor. No, you're not. You condemned them to stupidity. That's your fault. That's on you. You can't blame the kids. My kids grew up stupid. What environment did they come out of? Any responsibility on your part, you think? Of course there is. Absolutely is. And we got so many parents that are just horrible, bad examples of what parents are supposed to be. And the worst of them are the do-gooders who won't spank their children. Who won't discipline them when they need it. Johnny, you're going to get a timeout. Yeah, that thwarts me. Okay, I'll do my 2 minutes in the corner. Yeah, you know, put them in solitary for a week. Then let them see. That timeout might work. That's what they do to prisoners. You know, they make it a lot more difficult on them, but people don't want to make it difficult on their kids. Oh, I love my children. Guess what? You're not going to save them from this world. And if they go out there wildly unprepared. And as Christian parents, aren't we supposed to be trying to raise our children to be normal functional examples of doctrinal believers who do their right because they choose to. They want to. They want to please God. They want to serve God. So, what kind of son is there whose father does not discipline? There isn't one. They don't exist. Not in the normal world. Will be while the Bible commands that children are to be respectful and obedient to their parents, such is not always the case. You may have noticed this. Kids aren't always respectful and obedient. And especially as they get older. And especially, you know, you see it with boys, especially teenage boys. Because as they're getting older, they want to spread their wings. And again, you allow them as much freedom as you can. But the fact is, young men are stupid. And that's just the way it is. This is taught throughout the Bible. Foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. But the rod will remove it from them. But for those of us who didn't bother removing the foolishness from our child, guess what you got now? Stupid child. Oh, a stupid adult. Even worse. That's a failure as a Christian parent. You ought to mark that down as a huge failure and deal with it. So to the extent that you can still. 6:1, children, obey your parents in the Lord. For this is right. There's a textual issue and I'll have to look at it when I get there. But in the Lord is in brackets in some cases to try to soften it down. And that may very well be a scribal addition. Because this sounds like it's carte blanche. Obey your parents at all times. It is. So I'll have to look at the textual issue there, but I'm not going to count on it now. For this is right. This is righteous. If you want to be righteous, this is the way you do it as a child. You obey your parents. Colossians also 3:20. That's just, a parallel there. Same issue. Children, be obedient to your parents when you feel like it. or in all things, whichever you feel like. No, well, this is again very broad, supposed to be. For this is well pleasing to the Lord. Do you want to please God? Well, this is the way you do it. This party, the royal imperatives spell out how to please God. For children, it's obedience. For parents, it's respectful discipline. But discipline nonetheless, including corporal discipline. Well, again, which our country's thrown out the window, and now look what we got. We got schools where people carry guns and knives. And that never happened at my school when I was a kid. But then again, you knew if you did anything wrong. I remember one day I was cutting up in class. I was a bit of a class clown, you might imagine. And I was cutting up, and I got in trouble. And the teacher said, all right, you're going to get a SWAT. So, unfortunately, they took me down. She got some other guy. It was a female teacher. So, back then, they took you into the bathroom. They didn't just beat you in class. They didn't beat you. You got a SWAT. But it hurt. And nobody wanted. And on top of all of that, guess what? It's humiliating. You got to walk back into class. And you're embarrassed because you got disciplined. Well, the good thing was that day, my dad showed up. And stopped by, and I wasn't in class. And so he said, where's Ron? Well, he's down the hall with this guy, this other teacher. Why is that? Well, he's getting a SWAT. My dad wasn't happy. And I got more trouble when I got home. He said, I'm not going to discipline you any further because they already gave you your SWAT. But if you ever pull that again, you're going to get a whipping when you get home too. Okay. You know what? I never pulled it again. Somehow the threat of corporal punishment worked. Huh. I wonder if it still does. Well, we don't know in our culture. We couldn't tell you if it works. But I tell you it does. There's nothing like a little fear to motivate a child to obey. You say, well, that's how do you don't want to motivate him through fear. Yeah, you do. In the beginning, you have to. You have no choice. Because you're trying to get that stupidity out of their hearts. And fear is one of the ways to do that. I know I'm going to get in trouble if I do this. And that is a deterrent. Have you ever, as a child, even when you were young, stopped and said, well, I didn't do it just because I knew I'd get in trouble. I didn't care what all my friends were doing. They wouldn't get in trouble, but I would. So in such cases here, in cases of disobedience, natural affections and emotional considerations need to be overruled. And both parents are required to administer consistent... And people say, well, that's another whole thing. They want to just lay this off to the father. Well, the father's the disciplinarian. No, both parents are responsible. This does not let mothers off the hook. Well, I don't like spanking the kids. Well, do you think dad does? Well, he seems to. Well, no, he doesn't. I didn't like it. So it's a responsibility of both parents. Moms are not off the hook because they're moms. Well, I don't have to do this. It's the man's responsibility. The Bible doesn't say that. It says parents, last thing I checked. So both parents are required to administer consistent discipline, which must begin very early in the child's life. And people do not believe it, but I can guarantee you by the time a child is 6, 8, 10 months old, the child is starting to formulate ideas in that little head. And, you know, they're not coherent. They're not going to be doing algebra or anything like that, you know. But they're starting to formulate. And what are they figuring out? Can get whatever I want by crying. All I have to do is cry. Wah! And I get what I want. And it works. And then the child begins to lay there and think, I am a God. I can control my universe. You think, well, children don't think like... No, they don't think to that extent. I get that. But they figure out what works. And by the time they're 2 or 3, if you haven't disciplined them, they're already running that mouth. And what's the first word they learn? Dada? Mama? No. No is the first word they learn generally. They may make some sounds, but the first word they can get with comprehension is no. Because they know what that means. And so they begin to assert that little sin nature. Another birth has occurred, oh holy night. Another sin nature has come into the planet. And here we go. And they assert that little sin nature. And they stand up to you at 2, 3, 4. No. That should be spanked. No, you don't talk like that. No, yeah, just grab them, give them a little swat. You don't have to hurt them. But they need to associate. No, discipline gets this. And it doesn't have to hurt, but as it gets older, it has to hurt. You have to make it hurt. And that's against, you know, goes against our natural nature. We love our kids. We don't want to hurt them. But if you don't discipline them, you're hurting them worse. That's the big issue. All right, well, our time is gone. We're going to have to go ahead and stop there today. We will pick back up here on Tuesday. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to consider these matters. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our spiritual growth, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.